Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm making my grandfather Vertuca's spaghetti and meatballs in Park Ridge, Illinois. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 1034. What we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Usually, engineer Bob Ferguson is on duty in the WGN radio studio, but he has the weekend off, so Dan Long is helping us out. We appreciate that. So last week, I told you about my anniversary. It was last Saturday, so 1 week ago. And to celebrate, my wife and I, Jenny and myself and my two boys, Mikey and Joey, we went to the Cubs game, and it was just an awesome day. We went to Tunes, the greatest bar in Chicagoland at the corner of Southport and Byron beforehand. We had some wings, had just some good times, got to catch up with Danny Beck, the owner of Tunes. Go see Danny. Go see Tunes. It's seriously the best bar in Chicago. Awesome food. Great vibes. And then we went to Wrigley, and we got there really early, like an hour and a half early. We were sitting in the bleachers, so, you know, you had to give my kids that experience of going into the bleachers and sitting with mostly Cubs fans, some Yankee fans, so they learned some new words when we were in the bleachers last Saturday. But they had a great time, and they got the autograph of Dansby Swanson. We were there so early, we lined up on the side, and Mikey and Joey, Mikey's 11, Joey's going to be 9 very shortly here. And they both got Dansby Swanson's autograph. So that was just a great day. Now we're in the bleachers, and it's like in between, I don't know, the second and third inning. Jenny and the boys, they go to the bathroom. So I'm there with my mother-in-law, and in between the innings, the players in the field, they will, you know, throw the ball around to kind of stay loose. And when they're done throwing the ball around, they will throw the ball that they were using to stay loose, they'll throw that ball into the stands. So we're in the left field bleachers, and the Yankees are in the outfield, and they're staying loose. They're throwing the ball around. So the left fielder, I think his name is Max Schumann. I think I'm saying that right. He throws the ball up into the bleachers right by us, but way over our heads, like 5-6 rows back. And people are grabbing for the ball, bobbling the ball, and wouldn't you know it, that baseball just gets knocked right down onto me. I have a beer in my left hand. I stick out my right hand and I grab it, and I caught the ball used to keep the players warmed up in between innings. And I didn't know what the etiquette was there. I mean, if it's a home run that the Yankees hit, you got to throw it back. But this was just a practice ball. So I held on to it. Now, Mikey and Joey, my kids aren't there. I would have given one of them the ball, or both of them the ball. But somebody taps me on the shoulder and points to probably a girl about 6 or 7 years old in front of me. And, you know, people start chanting, "Give her the ball," because they don't see that my kids, my kids were there at one point. So I'm like, okay. So I gave her the ball, and the grandmother of this young girl turns around and says, "You know what? You have two boys. You keep it. We have 3 of these balls already." And I said, wait, you were here so often that you caught 3 balls, like either home run balls or just the practice baseballs. And she said, "Yep, you keep it. We have enough." So thank you to her. We also saw the greatest beer cup snake in the bleachers, which was phenomenal. And, you know, it's one of these giant snakes where people take their plastic beer cups, stack them up to make a giant tower. It looks like a huge snake, which I looked up in the rules. You can't do technically at Wrigley Field. But you know what? It was happening anyway. So the common theme that day at Wrigley was teamwork. The grandmother who said I should keep the ball, she didn't have to do that. and the teamwork needed to construct that giant beer cup snake in left field. It was a beautiful thing. You had Yankees fans and Cubs fans working together to make it happen. And I think that ties into the show today. We get an update on a West Side nonprofit that works to build a more inclusive community there. Teamwork. Also, integrating dance music with blues, flamenco, and hip-hop. We learn about an upcoming event that does just that. I'd call that teamwork. And do you know who Ferris Butler is? Not Ferris Bueller, Ferris Butler. A new documentary coming to Chicagoland answers that question. Is there a connection between Ferris Bueller and Ferris Butler? We will find out together. You know what I call that? Teamwork. We all know the name Ferris Bueller, especially in Chicago, but what about Ferris Butler? A new documentary called Saving Ferris Butler takes viewers on a ride through the life of former SNL writer Ferris Butler, a man whose career crossed paths with comedy legends and who says he was the real-life inspiration for one of the most iconic movie characters of the 1980s. It's a story full of big personalities, Hollywood history, and some other surprises as well. D.B. Frick is the host and executive producer of this film, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop. D.B., welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So this character of Ferris Butler, just broad strokes here, who was this guy? Who is this guy?
Okay, Ferris Butler is a New Yorker. He is a former Saturday Night Live writer. He is a cable access pioneer.
Uh-huh.
He married a woman named Beverly Ross, who is a well-known songstress. She wrote songs like Lollipop and Dim Dim the Light. She wrote with Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
He has all these connectors. He even took a class with Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
And met Martin Scorsese on several occasions. He is an eccentric, fun, boisterous personality who does not mince words and is not going to, definitely doesn't go with how the culture is so scared to say things. He's not as frightened to say those things that other people in the comedy culture might be afraid to say. And he's an older guy. He lives out in Nashville. He isn't at his healthiest, and he's good. You know, he's an old guy in a really nice place. It's like living in a Hilton.
Yeah, that's really right.
Like, yeah, he's in a really nice place in Burton Hills.
So this guy, Ferris Butler here, there's a lot that he's done. And I think that kind of eccentricity comes through in his past here. So he was a writer on SNL for one season. But it's interesting because Ferris Butler's brand of comedy, I mean, didn't necessarily mesh with what was popular at the time, but maybe kind of that weirdness is acceptable today. But that's really kind of his brand of comedy. And he does these other programs, like you said, this cable news kind of pioneer. But is his comedy, I don't know, is it like an acquired taste? Because it's not like it's, oh, knee-slapping funny. Sometimes it's just straight up weird.
Yeah, one of his most popular sketches that he's written is considered by many to be the worst sketch, and was even they even showed it in the Lorne Michaels documentary when they were talking about when Lorne left, because Lorne was not the producer at the time. That was the first season he wasn't a producer, and everything was sort of in disarray. Everyone left. They had a lot of new people, so they were trying new stuff. It was 1980, so I mean, that whole 70s disco thing was still going pretty strong at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the most popular season, and it's considered a notoriously bad season and is looked at as having some of the worst sketches ever. But I disagree. I think the Leather Weather is a simple, funny thing, and to call any sketch the worst sketch in the history of SNL is really a tough thing to do, because there's been so many. There's been so many sketches. How could one really say this one is the worst? But I kind of love that we're able to say that it's the worst, because I think that brings a little interesting attention to the project.
Yeah, and he was a writer. I think it was season 6 for SNL, and you mentioned the leather weather man, and that is definitely out there. But and you go into it in the film. Why did you want to dive into the story of Ferris Butler? For you, what was compelling? What was the story you wanted to tell?
It was sort of forgotten voices in comedy. You know, there are so many people that have done so much and are forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Like, here's an example. I just found out recently, when you submit to the Academy Awards as executive producer, you can't be up for that award. Just as an example of how strange.
That is weird.
It is very weird. And I, honestly, a lot of people did a lot of work on this documentary, but I've done like producer work. So, you know, it's interesting. It's also interesting how many people we have involved in this documentary. I got to talk to season 6 cast members like Patrick Weathers and Danny Dillon, who spoke to us, and even Emmy Award winning writers like Hugh Fink and Tom Bones Malone, who was ran the music and was one of the original Blues Brothers.
Right.
And then we have Jason Clamm, who just wrote a book called Ferris Bueller, You're My Hero. He's traveling all over the country talking about Ferris Bueller and all the stories behind how it came about. And I love that we're doing this in John Yoo's country. Like, we're bringing this home after a sold out world premiere in New York on the 40th anniversary of Ferris Bueller's Day Off's release. We did it on June 11th. That was very important to me that we did it that day.
Yeah. And we should mention that this film, Saving Ferris Butler, is coming to Chicagoland, coming to Park Ridge, the historic Pickwick Theater. That's at 5 South Prospect Avenue in Park Ridge. Wonderful theater.
Amazing.
It's just a great place. And this is happening for a week coming up in September. So Friday, September 18th through September 24th. You got a bunch of screenings. We can go check out this film, Saving Ferris Butler. You're coming here for a week.
Yeah, we're coming there for a week. We're coming there with the director, Julius Olivas, and Andy Hogland, who is a writer for Entertainment Weekly. He's one of our producers. We're going to come out there with Patrick Weathers, who is a cast member. He's going to come to the Q&As. And we're in talks with some other Saturday Night Live personalities to come down. But I don't want to say, they're not booked yet, so I don't want to say their names. But we are in talks to get people down for Q&As, and we're going to do a lot. We got 28 screenings happening in a week.
That is
awesome. A lot of opportunities, for sure.
Yeah. That's coming up September 18th. That's when it starts, through September 24th at the Pickwick Theater in Park Ridge. Just thinking about comedy and Ferris Butler's brand of comedy, we were saying how it's a little weird or off the beaten path. But today, I mean, when I look around at the comedy landscape, I think there's a lot of room for that. So in a way, was Ferris Butler a little ahead of his time, because he was doing these cable access like shows, Waste Meat News being one of them. And now you see kind of that style is back in vogue.
Yeah, he is, I would say, the godfather of YouTube comedy, the godfather of internet comedy, as Andy Hogland said in our movie. He was doing this 40 years before anybody else was. And it really, if you watch the sketches, they're so similar. Like in one sketch, a woman is talking about how much she loves Cadillacs, and driving a Cadillac is the greatest. But you know what's the best is when you steal a Cadillac and drive it. She steals the Cadillac and she's driving it around. She's like, this Cadillac's great. And it's great because it's stolen. It's just funny stuff like that. And there's so much subversive humor. And I believe not only was this came out, we have an article from TV Guide that we show in the documentary that says, if you want to watch Saturday Night Live sketches before they're on the show, go watch Waste Meat News. That was from 1976. And Waste Meat News came out just before Saturday Night Live.
Well, and you even have, you know, Weekend Update in SNL. And plenty of news spoofs that have been showing up consistently over the years on SNL. So I have to ask here, Ferris Bueller, Ferris Butler, is there a connection there? He thinks so. Ferris Butler thinks so. Did he inspire? And I don't want to give anything away, but does he inspire Ferris Bueller?
I think so. I give people the opportunity in the movie to choose for themselves whether they truly believe it or not. We do have people like Patrick Weathers who worked there that sixth season, who was friends with Ferris. And he has this amazing moment that he talks about where everyone's being fired. And there's one producer, Considine, I forgot his first name, but he has like a family of them in TV. And he's yelling in another room, "Save Patrick and save Ferris. Save Patrick and save Ferris." And Patrick tells this story and it's like you get chills as he's telling it because it's like, is that where it came from? Is that where Save Ferris came from? So there's a lot of connectors like that, but everyone's got to choose for themselves in the end.
I think you're right about that. And the film is a lot of fun and we can check it out. It's coming to the Pickwick Theater in Park Ridge, the historic Pickwick Theater, starting Friday, September 18th. And the website is savingferrisbutler.com. So we can check out that website, get all the information on the film. And it's a lot of fun. D.B. Frick is the executive producer of the film Saving Ferris Butler. And he's also the host. He's kind of the main sort of character driving the thing in the film. So, D.B., it's great talking to you. Congrats on the film. This is a very cool story, and I think people are going to enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I hope you come down to the movie. You got a ticket waiting for you already.
This Monday, August 10th, we can check out a unique dance event happening at Space in Evanston. It's Clenard Dance's Flamenco Quartet Dance Project, and it's connecting the flamenco perspective to jazz, blues, and hip-hop music. Wendy Clenard is the founder and director of Clenard Dance, based in Chicago and online at clenarddance.org. Wendy, welcome back to Outside the Loop.
Hey, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. So we've talked about what you're up to with your dance company before, but I know flamenco for you, you love flamenco. So just remind us, if we're not quite sure, maybe like we think about, we know it when we see it, but what is flamenco?
Well, I'm sure I won't be able to answer it entirely, but like a cliff note version is... you can start with the geography, which is the south of Spain about 500 years ago. And we see it surrounded, that peninsula surrounded by waters. So there were many cultures coming and going through those port cities and, you know, through the Straits of Gibraltar, an hour and a half from Africa. So flamenco is a lot of cultures coming together, exchanging ideas that sometimes had upwards of 200 years of migration before it got to the south of Spain, and processing what it was to be alive, which was not so different about our current being alive, the all kinds of things happening and doing what art does so well beyond, you know, if you can't speak the same language in words, you can sometimes speak it in rhythm or harmony and articulate a discontent or a joy. And flamenco does it mind-bogglingly well.
And the amazing thing here is, and you, I know you've pointed this out before, but this art form, right, this rhythmic kind of approach to dance and music, but it really complements the other genres that you have now involved yourself with really well. And the idea here to connect these different styles of music and art and incorporate that into this show that you're putting on here, where did that come from?
You know, I'll start in one place, but I'm not even sure if it has a beginning or certainly not an end. But it's that rhythm and harmony, or I think the other huge piece is having really authentic artists with a super long history of that art form in the same room together. So, you know, we have a spectacular percussionist, Diego Alvarez, who has like his roots in Venezuela. And then like a 25 year history of being in Spain, working with a huge artist, Cachito, who comes from a Roma family. Then we have Billy Branch here locally, who has such a huge legacy in blues, working with Willie Dixon and all kinds of great blues artists. You have King Musa, who brings his life story and his spontaneous writing. And so it's like when all those people, or Joan Colasso, when all those people get in the room together, Jumani Taylor, something happens. And sometimes I have to go back and say, hey, how did that happen? Sometimes it happens because of a beat cycle. Sometimes it happens because King Musa's like words that he writes that like get you in the stomachs, and then that makes something happen. Or Billy Branch reaches into his bag, historical bag of blues, because Musa, you know, shares this piece of verse and he's like, I got just the right lyric to go with that. So it's that sort of constant exchanging. The capacity is huge once that happens.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing when you listen back to the music, and really, this is kind of like a multimedia event. We're talking a lot about music and rhythm, but you are going to have at Space in Evanston coming up on Monday, dance, you have some visual art in addition to the music, and really, when you put it all together, it is amazing to hear how, you know, when Billy Branch is blowing that harp, And he's playing this blues, and it's really kind of syncing up with the flamenco style. And then this amazing style of dance that comes out of it, not just the flamenco, but also hip hop. It all just comes together and it flows so well. So I'm wondering here, like, what have you learned doing this now? You've done this for a little while with Clenard Dance. What do you think you're learning from seeing this event happen?
Beauty, form, and beat. I'm learning about talking to one another, be it through music or fill in the blank. I mean, communicating. When you come together, what comes out of that? And then the other thing I'm learning is that So we're talking about this inner multidisciplinary thing happening really naturally. But the other thing that I'm finding is like, sometimes we can even push beyond art. Like we can hook this project up with a campaign and perpetual punishments or different things that are like, there's a big justice impacted in individuals that are in and out of the work through King Musa's work and my work. I teach at Logan Women's Correctional. So there's a lot of campaigns because you look at these verses and these verses are about our stories. And so those maybe it's a verse or commission now from a campaign to start having conversations. Art's a great place to start inviting people into a conversation, and we're inviting them into learning about our carceral state. Let's say, for example, in the work we've done, and we're inviting them through their ear and through their eyes, and even sometimes in their body when we're showing up in public spaces. And you know, building awareness and then I'll just stop there. Then what people do with their awareness is the next step. So again, I go back to capacity. It's like I'm learning. I'm constantly learning.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And really, that's what art's all about. I think we can still take from these different genres and these different styles, even if we think we've seen it before. Not quite like this. And that's coming up this Monday, August 10th, 7:30 p.m., Space in Evanston. Tell us about the event happening on Monday.
Yeah, well, let me take this chance to shout out about one journey of one of the artists, Andrea Salcedo. She is a Mexican-American young woman who started here at, over at Merit Music. And, you know, I just love this spirit because I've watched her over time. And then she's been the last 7 years in Spain through a program, an awesome program. And, you know, finding her way now through all over the world, really, as a female flamenco guitarist. And she's been in and out of the project. She and Dan Corelli, another, like, he's one of our blues guys here, blues guitarist. So I'm excited to have Andrea back on the project. It feels like a little bit of, you know, that, you know, coming home event and being real proud. And, in what else? Let's see. Monday, we have Joan Colasso, who's just epic jazz vocalist, King Musa, Brian Harrington, Diego Alvarez, Jose Diaz Cachito, singer, of course, Billy Branch, and the awesome tap artist, Jumani Taylor, on Monday. So that's a good, those are good ingredients for a really good soup, you know?
That's right. The event, which we can all go to, and we can go to the website, clenarddance.org, to get tickets, is happening at Space in Evanston. That's at 1245 Chicago Avenue in Evanston at 7:30 p.m. this Monday. And it really is just an amazing multimedia, multi-genre event that I think a lot of folks are going to enjoy. So we could go to the website, clenarddance.org. And Wendy Clenard is the founder and director of Clenard Dance. Wendy, you're doing some great work, some really innovative work when it comes to art in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Total pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Talk a lot these days about the importance of mental health, but access to care is another story. For many LGBTQ+ Chicagoans, finding affordable, affirming counseling can still be a real challenge. A Westside nonprofit is working to change that by expanding its services to offer free mental health care, and it's doing so based on what community members have been asking for. Hannah Peewee is the Assistant Communications Director at Task Force Prevention and Community Services based in Austin, and she is here with us on the show today. Hannah, welcome back. It's nice to talk to you again.
So good. Thanks for having me back, Mike.
Yeah, you bet. So we talked in October on this program, and that was because you were celebrating an anniversary. I think it was 35 years in the community, which is amazing. So just briefly here, refresh our memory. What is it that Task Force Prevention and Community Services does on the west side of Chicago?
Yeah, so Task Force, we were founded in 1990. So we've been around for over 35 years now. And we provide social support, free healthcare, community services to the Austin community, particularly LGBTQ people. And we also have our infamous Vogue School, which is one of the biggest Vogue schools in Chicago.
So when we think about what specifically you're doing on a daily basis here, you know, we've talked about before that on the west side of Chicago, it's primarily people of color. And the intersection of youth of color and the LGBTQ+ community, we don't often talk about that connection or where that intersection is, but you really have programming that impacts that specific group. So what are some things that you're doing?
Yeah, for sure. So we overall try to identify where the disparities are and then rise to fill in those gaps. And so when it comes to queer people, people of color, it's not that we necessarily, when it comes to this therapy program that we built, it's not that we're inherently less mentally healthy. Instead, what we see is that our communities are exposed to increased triggers. So we're more prone to experience rejection, discrimination, violence, instability, and just overall the pressure to navigate spaces where we don't feel safe. And so wherever possible, Task Force tries to again step in and help provide support for navigating all of those factors.
And you mentioned there really kind of the history, right? The 20th century history of, I should say the second half of the 20th century history of the West Side. And there are some struggles that these communities in the West Side of Chicago are still dealing with today because of that history. So the residents there, the people that come to you at Task Force Prevention and Community Services, what are some things that they're telling you specifically? What do they need living where they live?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of everything, which is why Task Force really is kind of a one-stop shop. That's why we provide healthcare, housing, food access, employment, training, and opportunities. And so we've really been trying to provide holistic support. And it was from those people that have been coming to visit us that we realized there was a gap in the mental health we could be providing. The people that were coming to us were telling us like, yeah, like I would love to go to therapy, you know, like we need therapy, but I just don't feel comfortable talking to certain therapists, or I don't even have access. Like, I don't know where to even find a therapist or where to even start. And so it was from the people directly that we support that we realized we needed to step up and step in.
And I mentioned that there is this expansion of free mental health services for the folks that come to your nonprofit on the West Side of Chicago. So tell us, what does that mean? Because when we think about LGBTQ plus folks, and like you're saying, folks from Austin and other areas of the West Side of Chicago, and mental health, specifically, what does that care look like?
So I think it looks like a number of different factors. I think to start with, it needs to be low barrier. Like we talked about, a lot of people are interested in therapy, but they just don't know where to start, whether they just don't have health insurance or transportation and all that stuff. And so removing the barriers was the first step. So making sure that it's free, you don't need health insurance to receive therapy at Task Force. We can help you get health insurance if you need it. That's another service we provide, but again, it's not required. And secondly, it also looks like the therapy that's being provided being culturally sensitive and relevant to the lived experiences of the people that visit Task Force. So our therapy is provided by Annette Sandoval, who is a bilingual English and Spanish speaking therapist of trans identity. And she has lots of experience supporting LGBTQIA and marginalized communities. So not only can they receive therapy, again, no insurance, no cost, but also be coming with someone that can directly relate to their lived experiences.
And so when people who are part of this community come to you, they're looking sometimes just to talk. You know, we think about therapy and mental health therapy, and sometimes people just need to get things off their chest and talk about what's going on in their lives. And when folks are part of the LGBTQ plus community, sometimes they don't find acceptance even at home. And so they need someone to talk to. Is that kind of the angle? Is that what you're offering here as part of your services?
Yeah, absolutely. What's great is that since Task Force has been around for over 35 years, we're really trusted in the community. We're really known in the Austin neighborhood. And so this is really just an extension of that trust. It was really important to us to have someone on site, someone that participants could really get to know personally, you know, develop that close relationship with, so that way they felt comfortable opening up to them. It wouldn't just be a stranger. It would be someone that's they see around Task Force, you know, when they come to visit for their other support needs.
When we think of the West Side of Chicago, and you were talking about this a little bit in our conversation here, Hannah, thinking about acceptance and community. And like I said, that's an area, I know you're based in the Austin neighborhood, but the West Side in general is an area that's gone through a lot over the years. So when we think about trying to build a culture of acceptance, and look, this is something that we could talk about in other communities as well, where we're trying to think about how people are just going to get by on a daily basis and be respected. Not everyone has to be friends, right? But we're thinking about a culture of acceptance, trying to build that in the west side of Chicago. And you are one part of that, I should note, because there are other nonprofits out there that are doing great work, and that's a wonderful thing. But what do you think your role is with Task Force when we think about building or working on building that culture of acceptance in Chicago and beyond?
So I think for us, with implementing this program, the biggest lesson we've taken away as an organization is that effective mental health care doesn't always have to require building something completely new from the ground up. If you have, like you spoke to the other trusted community organizations, like this is a practice that anyone can implement by just integrating therapy into places where those relationships always exist, or if they don't have the capacity to do it themselves, partnering with other providers when additional capacity is needed. So currently, Task Force, we have the one therapist, Annette, but we're also partnering with the Chicago Therapy Collective to refer people to if Annette's schedule is busy. And so that's another Chicago-based organization dedicated to providing low to no cost therapy services. And so we're always happy to partner with other organizations doing the work.
And you've been around, like we were saying, for over 35 years. The response from Austin, from the West Side, I would imagine, I mean, it's largely positive, because here you are over 35 years later doing this work. It seems that the community has accepted you and is supportive of you.
Yeah, I would like to think so. I think so. And that's really, again, through this collaborative relationship, right? Like, Task Force exists to serve the community. Again, going back to what I was saying earlier, when people come in saying we need therapy, we say, how's it going to happen? And that's something that we've been consistently doing throughout our history as an organization. When we realized that the community needed more food access, we stepped up and created a food pantry. You know, that wasn't something we got funding to do. That wasn't a part of our original AIDS-focused mission. But again, the community expressed a need. We stepped up and provided the service. And now things like the food pantry are some of the most utilized resources at Task Force. And so I think a big reason we've been able to just foster such a positive relationship with the community is really that we're really responsive to their needs. You know, the community members are also collaborators in what the organization does.
And I think that's wonderful. You're in the neighborhood, you're in the community, you're responding to the needs of the community. And that's it. I mean, that's what we need to be doing in the West Side, but also beyond, just in Chicagoland. I think that's the goal here, to have these great organizations responding to our needs. We could check out the website taskforcechicago.org, and I think you're doing some great work over there, Hannah. Hannah Peewee is the Assistant Communications Director at Task Force Prevention and Community Services. Hannah, thanks for chatting on the show today, and keep doing what you're doing. It's great work.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 1034 is done. Thank you very much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Dan Long, who is our engineer, filling in for Bob Ferguson on the show today. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.